Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to Michael Gould-Wartofsky, who is the author of The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. Michael's book is published this year by Oxford University Press. I hope that you enjoy this interview that I did with him. Welcome back to the podcast. Again, I have the pleasure to talk with the author of The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement, published this year by Oxford University Press. Michael Gould-Wartofsky, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the program.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on. Before we get to the book, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself. You, like me, are both New Yorkers, I think, at least in residence. But tell us just a little bit about where you are now, where you've been, any affiliations. Share with us a little bit.
Sure. So, yes, I've been a New Yorker pretty much all my life, and I'm currently a PhD fellow in sociology at New York University. I also hold a BA in government from Harvard University, where I graduated in 2007. Of course, I graduated into the Great Recession and got kind of swept up in the events that followed with the Occupy movement in 2011, 2012, and just kind of honed in on some key questions that had been, I think, left unanswered by the academic literature as well as by the media narrative. So, that's where I am today.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I was just so curious about how this fits in. If this is your dissertation or if this is a piece of your dissertation, we can talk about that as we go.
Sure.
But let's talk about the book itself. I think your book does a really good job of explaining the roots of the Occupy Wall Street movement. So before we end up in Wall Street, before we come to Manhattan, what came before this? What were the predecessors kind of geographically, but also in terms of where it took its inspiration? So give us a little bit of the background.
That's right. So let's recall the conditions and the kind of dual crisis that we were seeing in 2011, 2012. On the one hand, the sort of unwinding crisis of financial capital and the crisis, economic crisis that had extended to basically all but the top 1% of the income and wealth distribution. You had that on a global scale. So there was, first of all, halfway around the world, a wave of occupations that set off revolutionary events with what's known as the Arab Spring, although it extended well beyond that. And there was a kind of Mediterranean Spring as well, with another wave of occupations spreading to cities in Spain and Greece. And actually, New York City had its first one in June 2011 over an austerity agenda, a series of budget cuts that were about to be made. And so this was really a dual crisis of financial capitalism and also of representative democracy, as a lot of young people, especially in many of these societies facing the aftermath of the crisis, did not see a future under the current regime. And so there were regimes successfully overthrown in Tunisia, Egypt. Of course, these were qualitatively different contexts, but they were the source of inspiration and really had a demonstration effect on many of the occupiers who would become the occupiers of Wall Street in September 2011.
And what about the 99% movement phrase? You also talk a little bit about where this comes from. What's its history?
Right. So the 99% movement, and this is the subtitle of the book, and that is it is the identity, the collective identity that was really taken up at the time by the participants in the movement. So I wanted to go with that self-definition. But it came out of poor people's movements in New York State and other places around the country, but specifically an occupation of the Capitol building in Albany, New York, in March 2011, was then sort of taken up by the New York City General Assembly, which responded to the call to occupy in August 2011. So that was a kind of transition from a very kind of local grassroots struggle against austerity to one that was much more generalized and was targeting, of course, one of the great capitals of capital in the world, right? And so the 99% became a meme. It became a narrative that allowed people to identify who was on their side as they saw it and who was on the other side, that is the 1% that they identified with, the kind of with the responsibility for the crisis and with responsibility for the conditions that they were facing, and who were taking home at that point 95% of the gains from the economic recovery. So this was really a story that that hit home for people, and people took up the "We Are the 99%" identity, and it really became a point of unity that was long absent, at least in the political left in the United States. and really extended beyond what we know to be the left to a much larger base of people.
Now, protest movements are almost always studied post hoc, either through retrospective interviews or archival material. Your method in this book is very different. I wonder if you could talk to us about when it occurred to you that you could participate in this Occupy movement as a scholar. Maybe you could tell us also just a little bit about sort of how you first became aware of it and when sort of the wheels started to turn that this was something that might be linked to what you could study.
That's a good question. So this is a participant observation study. It's what I call a motive embedded inquiry. And this required participation observation in the fullest sense of the terms of participation and observation. I didn't realize that I was going to write this book until after the eviction of Zuccotti Park in New York City, also known as Liberty Square at the time. But I did have ethnographic notes, field notes. I did have photos and many hours of footage. And I had interviews from the square during the time that it was occupied. I just thought that this was going to be an important moment in our social and political history, and I wanted to document it just for the sake of documenting it. And then when I realized that I could also do a study that critically reflected on it and didn't just kind of wasn't just an archive, but also an analysis, right? I thought that there was an analysis that was lacking at the time from much of the coverage and for much literature. So I wanted to make whatever contribution I could make by drawing that all together into a synthesis that gave me a participant perspective, but also some critical perspective on relations within the movement, as well as relations between the movement and the state.
So one of the fascinating parts of your book is how you explain the very specific tactics that protesters use to adhere to the restrictions that the police had put in place. And so, what were some of these restrictions first? You know, what were the restrictions on the protesters? And then what were some of the tactics that were adopted to adjust to these conditions? You talk about some of the communications tactics, some of the hand gesturing. Walk us through some of the really what it was like to be there and what was actually going on.
That's right. So, you know, we often get this this bird's eye view without actually seeing the social relations and the kind of political power relations as well within situations like this. Of course, there's a basic asymmetry of power between protesters and police, especially in New York City. This is one block away from Ground Zero. This is a kind of stone's throw away from the gates of Wall Street, which were shut down. And traffic was very tightly regulated from September 17th on. What was initially intended as an occupation of Wall Street became more of a metaphorical way of saying we're occupying near Wall Street. So the occupation was contained pretty quickly, but for whatever reason, it was sustained over the course of 2 months. And I think, you know, I really get into some of the political struggles that were occurring also within the municipal governments and you know, between different agencies and authorities over what to do, because this was a privately owned public space, as it's referred to. So there was no real roadmap for how to manage, how to sort of organize a space there that was being occupied. So the police department initially just kind of set up a perimeter and eventually day by day started imposing further and further restrictions. So restrictions on you know, people could use amplified sound. Those were some of the first arrests. And so as a result of that, the occupiers turned to the tactic of the people's microphone, which allowed them to communicate by echoing and call and response back to each other, and communicating very effectively, I think, you know, within the parameters that and the constraints that they were facing. Another example.
But before you go, just tell us how that actually works. I think most people wouldn't quite know what you mean by this. So logistically speaking, how does this people's microphone work?
That's a good question, and the dynamics of it, the sort of mechanics of it, are one thing that I tried to describe in the book. But basically, one individual who would like to speak and would like to be heard in the occupied square would say, "Mic check." This is a phrase that's inherited from the world of hip hop music, and would be echoed back with another person saying, "Mic check," and then other people would realize that there was a mic check and would echo it back. And so every line or every few lines Someone would speak, you know, someone who would normally not be heard across the square, would be projected, you know, through many voices, and sort of waves, at least up to three waves across the square, so that everybody could hear what they were saying without putting people at the risk of arrest for that particular offense. So there were all these kind of creative tactics and techniques that people came up with, and this was one that was replicated all over the country and the world, actually, and still is being deployed today in today's protests.
Another aspect of the book that I was very intrigued by was the coalitional nature of Occupy Wall Street, and also the factions that emerged. So how unified were these protests, and what were some of the dividing lines that started to emerge as things progressed?
That's right. So from the first, this was at first an assemblage of sort of far left factions that didn't normally work with each other or even speak to each other. But I think in the context of this crisis, and specifically around the time of the debt ceiling deadline, which you remember was a very polarizing moment politically, and on the day of the debt ceiling in 2011, these rival factions of anarchists and socialists and sort of unaffiliated young people came out to this first New York City General Assembly to oppose what they called the austerity agenda and the this 1% power that was beginning to be one of the major sort of themes and tropes here. But the one thing that drew them together was this oppositional politics, this opposition to the politics of the 1%, as they saw it, and this marriage of state power and corporate power. Other than that, there was much that that they disagreed on, and there were many points of contention and contradiction. So the question of whether an occupation was the right thing to be doing in the first place, the question of sort of how if at all do they relate to the police, do they communicate with the police, the question of permits and tactics and what kind of what is permissible and what is not, and even the question of whether there should be any organization at all, sort of driving this thing. So those were some of the lines of the fault lines that really divided people from the very beginning, and those fault lines only became deeper as the pressure mounted from the outside.
One of the things I think that we sort of conventionally know, but that you also reflect in the book, is the very amorphous and somewhat almost purposefully unfocused nature of the Occupy movement, and you know, a very purposeful attempt not to have a single leader emerge to speak on behalf of the group, very democratic in that fashion. But it does lead people to ask the question related to success. I wonder if you've thought about at all how successful the Occupy movement was or is. How do you think about success? If some of our typical notions about social movements and political movements don't quite fit here. For instance, how many people were newly elected based on their affiliations with this? It really didn't work that way. How do you look at success and failure related to the Occupy movement?
So I think the question we have to ask is successful at what? And of course, by the conventional metrics of both social movements in this country and social movements around the world, as well as even those of more limited scope than this one, I think, you know, it doesn't really meet the criteria for a successful social movement by the conventional metrics of what constitutes a successful conventional social movement. But I think that one of my points in the book is that this wasn't in and of itself a social movement, but rather Occupy was a moment in a much longer wave of mobilization, social and political mobilization. This particular moment was a kind of it was one that provided a locus for sort of people to meet for face-to-face convergence, and it was also one that provided a focus for people to act, for collective action. And so it was also a moment when the media was actually paying attention. So that, you know, we don't identify the longer arc because it kind of very rapidly faded from view. But I think that if we look even right now with the fight for 15 or the continuing attention in the presidential race to income inequality, which was also a theme in 2012, I wonder whether these kinds of frames and these kinds of this kind of politics would have been possible without the Occupy moment. And so I think it's still too early to tell or to say definitively at what, you know, what place in the causal chain we can locate Occupy Wall Street. But I think that, you know, it certainly succeeded at changing what people were talking about. And I think that's not what change looks like, but it's a precondition for change. So perhaps a necessary but not sufficient condition.
So this is such an interesting book, and I'm sort of very fascinated with where this fits into your own scholarship. Is this your dissertation? Is this a piece of it? Maybe we can sort of wrap up by you talking a little bit about where this fits into your own sort of broader agenda.
Absolutely. So this is not my dissertation. It's certainly related, but my dissertation is on the topic of immigration and of movements surrounding immigration and state society relations around the question of immigration. So the way that I see this fitting together is we're looking at sort of different responses to the economic and political crises that we've seen over the past decade or so. And I think that the politics of the 99% is a kind of, it's one that aspires to some kind of universality. It's one that asserts that that there can be a sort of political progress in the fight for greater social and economic equality and for some degree of political power for the majority of the country, which is the criterion for democracy, as we know. So this is on the one hand a response to the crisis of representative democracy that we see in the Occupy moment and also in the disenfranchisement of millions of people who consider themselves Americans and by all accounts are Americans. So there's also the question of criminalization, which connects the two. And there's the question of, what will the future of sort of the political left in this country look like? And I think Occupy and the immigrant rights movement provide two different faces of two different dimensions of what that future might look like.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And your book, The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement, published this year by Oxford University Press, is widely available. Michael, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.